Welcome to the Scary Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Swearinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us an awesome 5-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about cybersecurity technology news headlines to hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical application that you can take in the office to help you protect your organization.
And as usual, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone. Do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
99% of lawyers give the rest a bad name.
I think that's too low.
That was less offensive than the other jokes.
It's like, it should be 5 nines.
Nines of lawyers.
You ever see the movie Interstate 66?
No.
That's pretty good. It's very libertarian, though.
But it involve lawyers, I assume?
There's a town full of nothing but lawyers, 100%. 100% of the people who live in this town are lawyers. Anybody who happens to stumble into the town gets prosecuted for something.
That sounds awful.
Yeah, I think that's the joke.
That's fair. All right, so our first article today, and we might only get to one because we're looking at this. Our first article, we picked out two, but this one seemed... this one ended up being longer than we thought. And somewhat difficult to parse. But it is called Blessed Are the Lawyers, for They Shall Inherit Cybersecurity, from Venture and Security. Ross at Venture and Security has brought up an academic paper called Blessed Are the Lawyers, for They Shall Inherit Cybersecurity. The summary of this paper describes how the current quantitative practitioners of cybersecurity have failed to accurately guide risk decisions. They argue that lawyers prepared by ambiguity in the law are more appropriately positioned to make good decisions in regard to legal risk, as opposed to the quants, as they call them, making good decisions about technical risk. Interestingly enough, they don't say that technical risk disappears, just that lawyers will be able to provide more concrete decisions as the legal regime changes slower than the technical regime changes, so they can provide more certainty for legal risk than quants can provide for the technical risk. They say this will lead to lawyers being prioritized more often, and therefore what they're calling their ascendancy. I don't know if I 100% buy this argument, but for the sake of the article, we will go along with it. They listed out a number of consequences of lawyers taking over cybersecurity risk decision-making. The first one is reduced information sharing. To lawyers, information is evidence, and if you share potential evidence, you may increase your legal liability. And we'll talk about these more in more detail down at the bottom. We're just going to go through kind of the summary first. Number two, reduced documentation. As a result of lawyers being more involved in IR, they found that reports have moved towards being informal and verbal because they want to reduce the amount of documents that are discoverable. If you, you know, say, oh, this was our fault in an email, now that's discoverable in court. And a move towards reasonable versus effective. The authors of the paper argue that lawyers prefer reasonableness or appropriateness as a criteria over effectiveness. The comparison is the old statement, no one gets fired for buying IBM. And this is going to lead to more decisions related to security compliance. I didn't include this in the notes, but they mentioned this in the paper, that there's a lot of talk of reasonable or appropriate controls in like the SEC's regulations and other government regulations.
Written by lawyers.
So this is going to be about making sure that the company doesn't get in trouble the next time it's attacked or breached. It's not going to be focused on making sure the attackers don't get in.
Yeah, there's another consequence, which is making cybersecurity evil.
Everything they touch. And when they say inherit, they mean that the legal reasoning and decision-making will replace technical reasoning and decision-making at the leadership level. They're not saying that technical decision-making is going to disappear, just that it's going to be deprioritized and done at lower levels, and CISOs are going to be more focused on the legal side. Now, Ross comments in his article. So this was Ross's response to this academic paper. The academic paper was about 14 pages and was written in very academic language, which was a little tough to read. I'm a smart dude, but I hate academic papers like that.
Yeah, and it had 3 pages of footnotes.
So Ross comments on this, that he thinks that he says that what they're saying is true, but only available in companies that are spending the most, because he talks about, quote, engineering-centric enhancements like continuous testing, continuous compliance, detection engineering, policy as code, those types of things. Companies that spend a lot of money and are, we talked about this before, kind of engineering companies versus the new type of company, software-based companies versus old-school companies. He's saying that only the new software companies, which start off early and they don't have, you know, legacy issues, they don't have that years of historical debt, and they're able to take advantage of the most modern tools. He said he thinks that those guys are going to be able to quantify the risk effectively. But the old school companies are still doing stuff by the, what is it, Oracle and Sears, and, you know, have devices in their network that are 30 years old and, you know, concretions of networks from various purchases and stuff like that. Like, those companies are never going to be able to do quantitative risk management. Their environments are too complex. And they're going to keep falling into this legal regime because that's what they got. All right. So that's the summary. Discussion points. My first item here is just a comment on lawyers. Like, isn't it a bad thing that the law is so ambiguous that it requires a whole class of people to interpret it? Seems like you would want the law to be clear cut enough that the average person could follow it, but.
Well, then you wouldn't have any lawyers if the average person could follow it.
I don't know what I was thinking.
Well, this stems from, you know, the common law concept of found law versus made law. You know, judges would use prior cases and prevailing communal attitudes to determine if the law had been violated. You know, this made sense, you know, a long time ago when was more workable when there were fewer laws versus today when, you know, what is it, 4,000 laws a day are getting written or something crazy like that, where they regulate everything under the sun, from what you can eat to how much water you can have in your toilet.
Beautiful. Just really beautiful.
Well, it is for them.
And frankly, don't we need, this question I can actually probably get rid of because they did address this later. I added this question though, as I was reading through it. Like, don't we need both? Don't we need people that can make both technical risk decisions and legal risk decisions? And as I worked my way through the paper, I saw later they did mention it. But it is.
I wonder if they're expecting or they're hoping that this is going to be embodied in the same people.
Oh, interesting.
Because he talks about how it's not that the lawyers will take over so much as the mindset of the lawyer will take over.
Yeah, they'll rely more on decision making based on legal rather than technical causes or reasons.
Right, and not necessarily the lawyers will do that per se, but that the idea of, you know, you talked about the, what was it, the reasonable and appropriate versus effective, that mindset takes over the thought process within security.
All right. Yeah, they point this out because, well, I mentioned that part before. Yeah, and I think the author mentions that that if he had time, if he had another 24 hours in the day, he might consider taking up law. It makes me wonder if kind of the perfect person they're looking for leadership positions. Cause you know, like a lot of the time right now, there's a push towards getting folks in management positions into MBA programs so that, you know, they have the technical knowledge and they have the business knowledge. I wonder if there'd be like a future program that incorporates the law into that.
Yeah. That's why I was thinking, I'm wondering if you're going to have either a master's degree in cybersecurity or even bachelor's degree in cybersecurity that have a law contingent or a law requirement.
Yeah. Is there an equivalent?
Pre-law stuff.
Is there an equivalent to an MBA, but more legal focused? Because you have to, no, probably not, because you have to pass the bar and be a lawyer to practice law.
Well, you have the, what the heck do they call it? Well, to practice law, you have to pass the bar, but they have the JD, what was it? Doctorate in jurisprudence or something?
Juris doctor. Yeah, JD is juris doctor or something.
Yeah, which I think is the equivalent there.
Yeah, there's a master of legal studies designed for non-lawyers who could benefit from a deeper understanding of the law but do not want to become a practicing attorney. Huh. So yeah, it does look like there's masters in dispute resolution. Juris doctor is a legal degree for people who are going to become a practicing attorney. Master of laws is for if you want to specialize in a particular area of law. So yeah, it does look like there are options.
Yeah.
Instead of an MBA, master of legal studies.
Now, when you said that, just remind me of class I took once was instructed by someone who had a master's degree in interrogation and detection of deception.
Yeah, that is a heck of a degree. All right, so if I do a search for Master of Legal Studies in Cybersecurity, CSU has this in Ohio. What is CSU? I mean, SU is obviously State University, Cleveland State University. That's interesting. So they're ahead of the game here. Maybe
Ohio usually is.
No, here's another one. Drexel University has a MLS degree, cybersecurity and information privacy compliance. That's interesting. It's 25 credits. Introduction to the legal system, compliance skills, ethics and professional standards, legal research, risk assessment and management. And then two capstone courses for 5 credits. That's interesting. That sounds more interesting than an MBA. I don't know that I care about an MBA.
Hmm.
Although maybe I'll find out that I don't care about legal stuff too. All right. Anyways, I do think
hopefully you find out before you spend too much money on it.
Yeah. No, I do think that that does present an interesting choice for people because in an ideal situation, you would want a CIO who knows the business, they know the technical aspects, and now they have to know the legal stuff too. That's a lot to ask.
I think we'd better to have the CISO be a technical person and then their deputy be a lawyer, maybe.
Really? Most places, I feel like, do the opposite, where they put the less technical person in the leadership role, and then they have like a more technical deputy to actually do the implementation. I'm not arguing. I'm not saying it should or should not be that way. I just feel like in most places.
Yeah. It sounds right.
Yeah, that's fair.
But I think one of the points that the paper is trying to make, though, is that the more the legal risk, you know, the consequences of a compromise, whether it be executive personal liability or the cost of lawsuits or whatever, once the legal risk is more weight than the technical risk, then that's the point where the legal considerations are going to be more than the technical considerations for defense.
Yeah, I think that day might have already passed, honestly. I think that already the legal, I mean, we'll talk about this in a bit. Nowadays, there's very little technical issue. We'll talk about it a bit. All right, next question. What do you think about the argument that lawyers will provide better guidance than what quote-unquote quants? Although I think regardless of whether or not it's better advice, I think C-levels are probably more comfortable with lawyers than they are with technical professionals.
Yeah, I think it might come down to personalities and trust. You know, if the C-suite has more faith in the CISO than the OGC, then the CISO may take the lead versus the other way around. So it might actually come down to the personality conflicts or personalities in the organization itself.
I could see that. And I could especially see that with maybe, because I imagine that the CISO will be very comfortable with the technical folks since he came up through that group, but he may be a lot less comfortable. And I mean, the CEO may be a lot less comfortable with the technical folks. The CEO will be way more comfortable with kind of the lawyers because they deal with lawyers all the time.
Yeah. And they're probably from the same cast.
Yeah. Yep. Went to the same schools and all that kind of stuff. It's another version of haves and have nots, which as I mentioned before, the comment about Ross, we're well-funded and kind of the software driven company. They're going to have effective and measured security programs where they can actually put like a quantifiable change in risk based on new content rolled out or choosing one tool or another tool. But the less effective ones are going to have to make do with the legal decision-making.
In the small organization where you have, you know, one cybersecurity guy or two cybersecurity guys, and probably you have 10 lawyers. A legal, what's that?
And probably 10 lawyers.
Right. Yeah. And you have an OGC office, which has got a lawyer or two in it.
Yeah.
You know, who are you going to believe? The guy in the hoodie or the guy with the tie?
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and jump to this part before. It's item 6 on the list. So Ross mentioned that the effects of security incidents on stock price has been mostly nil. There's a couple exceptions. We've called out a couple of companies that have been driven into bankruptcy because of a security issue, but like Target dipped for a bit, came back. SolarWinds has not, but CrowdStrike has. If many security breaches don't really matter to the stock price, now of course this is for publicly traded companies, it's externalized to the user whose data is lost, then does a breach really matter? And interestingly, this explains the focus on ransomware for a business perspective as a type of attack that actually does impact how you do business. If they steal your information, that doesn't change how you do business. But when they ransom and shut down your systems, now you are no longer making money.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's because ransomware is more akin to theft versus the stealing information. The stealing information is actually copying it, right? Mm-hmm. The ransomware is actually denying you access to that as if they'd taken it from you. So that is more like theft versus simply copying what you have.
No, yeah, it's like turning a digital good into a physical good because they've destroyed your copy of it.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Can you imagine if somebody like stole a bike and they just left a copy of the bike? Or they just had a second copy of the bike. You're like, oh, I don't care. let them ride from their copy of a bike.
Right.
So, okay. So
that's why, a lot of people are say that, you know, theft of intellectual property or anything like that can't be actually categorized as theft because it is not denied you access to this, to that. So you can't call that theft at all.
It's interesting. Yeah. So let's go back to the original question that I distracted us from there though. Does the breach really matter? Like in terms of if you have a breach and it costs you a couple million dollars in response or, you know, hiring Mandiant or someone to come in and your stock price dips briefly, but then rebounds, then maybe the money is better spent on quote unquote, the legal decision-making to try and ensure you don't get sued versus the technical decision-making, which may come down to, we need to buy $10 million more worth of gear or something to fix us.
Well, I think that's the factual understanding of today is that the businesses have decided, you know, for, you know, as long as cybersecurity has been in existence, that money would be better spent elsewhere. Otherwise, they would be spending the additional funds necessary in order to ensure you're doing automated patch management and all that stuff. But they've decided that the effort and the money spent on building up the security is not worth the cost. I think this business decision has basically been made in, you know, a couple of decades ago and continues to be made in the same way. People just don't like to hear that or like to think of it that way.
Yeah. And nobody likes thinking that that attackers stealing your data is totally fine. They did bring up that firms offering free credit monitoring after a breach are 6 times less likely to get sued. That's the type of thing we're going to get from, you know, legal decision-making. We're going to get a lot more solutions like that rather than technical solutions. You know, maybe it costs us $1 million to provide free credit monitoring from our partner versus it costs $5 million to upgrade the firewalls and hire 2 engineers to tighten them down.
Yeah, that kind of annoys me because I wonder how much value is there really in credit monitoring?
None.
So really what they're saying is, you know, we're going to give you, you lost your arm, so we're going to give you a bagel or something. It's not really helpful for the situation you find yourself in.
That's serious. I want a bagel. I don't disagree, but that's kind of the point, right? Is that from their perspective, it's cheaper. It is a lot cheaper.
Well, it's also preys on the ignorance of people who don't realize that what they're really giving you is not helpful or is not really that all that useful. Because the companies at the end of the day realize that it's going to be difficult for you to prove actual harm when one of these data breaches actually does lead to actual harm for, you know, one of the people whose data was stolen. So it's the externalities problem that we talked about a couple episodes ago.
Yeah. As long as the impact falls on the people whose data was lost, the company doesn't care.
You know, and if you think about this in terms of credit card data, right? Mm-hmm. So before, this is probably, you know, very long time ago, I can't even remember in my lifetime when it was different, when credit card fraud was the problems or the downsides of credit card fraud was borne by the people who had the credit cards, the individuals who had the cards.
Yeah.
It was a lot more rampant until they changed the laws to put that on the credit card companies, where now people, you know, if I get my credit card stolen, don't really care, to be honest.
Yeah.
Inconvenient for me because I have to dispute some charges and have to wait for a new card. Other than that, it's not a big deal for me because they put all that, the trouble onto the credit card company. They have to suffer the losses, which also means they have to take the steps in order to prevent credit card fraud, which is why they spend so much money on doing so. You know, you have to make a similar thing happen for data theft in order to get that the risk of data theft down. So it's a matter of, you know, who ultimately is responsible, who's got skin in the game for data theft. Right now, it's not much skin in the game for the companies who maintain the data or carry or hold the data.
That makes a lot of sense. And yeah. Unfortunately, how do you get them to have more? It's got to be government regulation, right? Or we would have to do something as a people all together to force them to, Let's see how we could do it.
Well, I'm not a big fan of government regulation, obviously.
Yeah.
But
that's why I'm asking, because that would be the immediate first answer would be government regulation.
Yeah. It would probably be the most expedient, because in order to avoid the necessity for government laws and regulations around that, you would have to get common everyday people and the majority of them to understand or realize that that data is their property. It belongs to them versus belongs to the company. That way, if it's your property, you can have legal recourse to damages against it, versus now where it's the property of the company, but you're the one that suffers the externality for it. So the only way to do that in a rapid way, unfortunately, would be government regulation or laws around what the disposition of data is, who the owner of data is, versus people simply coming to that realization that it belongs to them because they're the ones that suffer the downside risk of data exposure.
Yeah, I would absolutely love to see a government law that officially defines all of the data that companies collect on you as owned by you. Like, you own your data, you own your DNA, you own your... And then we talked about this before, where I think you talked about someone who suggested like having an information vault that you could let companies access, but make them pay for it. Like, you can access my vault if you give me, you know, $5 for 30 days access or something like that.
Yeah. It actually almost reminds me of the incorporated ban, right, with the stocks.
Yeah. So I know that was presented in there as a big negative, but I actually like the idea of selling part of your self-ownership as stock. I think that you would just want to set it up so that people couldn't sell 51% of themselves. Or you could sell more than 51%, but like you can't give up a majority. Like, you can only sell an amount, you know, you could call it, you sell 100%, but you still have the ability to make your own decisions. They're just buying into your future of what they think you will do, how successful you'll be.
Yeah, I'm on the fence about it. Although I do lean towards that being a good idea.
I think it's better right now than the debt that students get into for life. Like, someone will loan your silly 18-year-old self, you know, $150,000 to go send you to college in some sunny beach town where you learn, you know, where you spend $120,000 on art, on an art degree, where you're going to make, you know, $15,000 a year for the rest of your life. But if you were selling stock in yourself, or you were selling like a slice of your future earnings, which is what the stock would represent, they'd be like, all right, well, what are your plans? You're like, oh, I'm going to go get a 4-year degree in art. And they'd be like, oh, nope.
I'm not buying your stock.
Nope, nope, nope.
What's that? I mean, it's just like, I'm not buying your stock for you to do that.
Right.
But the thing is that, but if that person is Van Gogh or Rembrandt, right, and they said they're going to do this, then sure, you want to invest in them.
But here's the thing.
It all matter. You can't lump everybody all into the same thing. Be like, okay, what do you want to do? Why do you want to do it? And, you know, does it make sense for me to spend the money on buying stock from you?
But I think that actually has some impact. Like, so let's say that you are a future Van Gogh or Rembrandt, and you're in high school and you're making wonderful art, and like, you're already like, people are seeing that art, and all the other kids in the school know, and the parents know, and the school teachers know. Like, they can sort of crowdsource by being like, oh, I believe in this kid, I'm going to buy stock in him. And then the stock starts going up. Right. It naturally starts going up. Like, you're introducing market forces into that.
Right.
That like allow you to start identifying those superstars.
Yeah. And actually incentivize them to go down the path which is going to be best for them.
Right. The path that you either make the most money or are most valuable So, and then you could have people that deliberately buy stock. You could have all sorts of, I'm thinking about like teachers and stuff like that. You could, if you were an organization who wanted to incentivize teachers, you could have like you buy teachers, people who are going to be teachers or teacher stock, and then choose not to take the dividend or whatever you would call it from there.
Or you just roll it, you'd roll it back into more stock purchases of them or something, right?
Yeah, or something like that. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there's definitely
like
ways.
I think overall like I said, I'm on the fence because there's good and bad aspects of it. I do lean towards more that it would be a beneficial method.
Yeah.
Especially like the fact that, you know, in the book anyway, the government only got 5% and never got any more and was basically relegated to doing nothing at all, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. But I mean, the negatives in there were, it would be interesting to see, Like, the part that I didn't like, the part that you could, the world was structured in such a way that you had to sell basically 51 or more percent of yourself, and then you spent the rest of your life trying to buy a control interest back.
Yeah, I think that you know, the book comes up with the concept, but I think the way that the book expects that concept to work out would not be the way that it works out. At least I don't think so.
I think you just need some guardrails. Let's say you can't sell a majority, or if you do sell, you know, however much, like, they can't tell you what to do.
Well, I think initially that you might run into some problems, but the longer the system existed, I think the lower people's time preferences would become, and they would not sell off too much of themselves because they realized the downside risk of doing so. Yeah. And I don't think that book portrays that too much, because the book portrays everybody is selling virtually their entire selves away.
Yeah.
Just to do anything that they want. And I think that in reality, like I said, the longer the system went on, the lower people's time preference would become, and the less of themselves they would sell away for frivolous reasons. So I think the author came up with a good concept, but reasoned it out incorrectly.
Yeah, you're right. I could see people, like frivolous people, being like, oh, I'll sell off 5% of my own stock to take this vacation. But as people got more used to it, they're like, whoa, that's flipping stupid. You only sell your stock for like college. Or
right.
Yeah.
And you got your parents guiding kids to say, okay, you're not going to sell 5% of your stock to throw a kegger.
Yeah.
In college.
Yeah. You know, probably all college student stock is worth.
Maybe. I don't know. But like you said, I think the concept is good. They didn't, but the reasoning behind how they think it would be implemented is not exactly accurate.
Can you imagine buying stock in, like, if you know a venture capitalist or something, and you're like, man, this guy's going to go far. Or one of my son's friends, the dude is brilliant. The dude is either going to become like the CEO he's going to become like an entrepreneur creating something, or he's going to be a criminal, one of the two. But if I had the option to buy.
In between, no average guy for that guy.
He is not going to be average. He is going to be wild. But if I had the chance to buy like futures in him in some way, I absolutely would. They'll probably turn out to be worth nothing, but they could turn out to be worth millions.
Right. It's
so interesting to be able to almost bet on like people you think are going to be, I don't know. All right. We're getting distracted.
A little bit far afield, but yeah, Unincorporated Man series, great books. Read them.
I need to get back and finish that.
I'm on book 3.
Wow. You're way past where I am. All right. What about using reasonable or appropriate as criteria for remediation's response? Now, part of the issue is that we still can't quantify effectiveness, so it's kind of hard to argue for that. We've done a terrible job of that due to issues of complexity and other things. And Ross points out as well, we've done a bad job of actually following the evidence of what makes an effective control. It's been known for years that longer is better than more complex for passwords, but there's still, you know, NIST changed it the other year, but there's still other places that are like, nope, you have to have so much complexity, one of these, one of those, and they even limit your length. What was I doing the other day? I shouldn't name them. A vendor site that I went on, I had to change my password, and they were limiting my password to 20 characters. I tried to put in a 24 character password, and it didn't. It was like, nope, you can't do this.
Yep. Well, I was buying something from a store, one off or whatever, that I was going to buy. It wasn't really something I was going to expect to go back to, but it forces you to make an account for it.
Of course.
And letters and numbers only.
That's what. This is
letters and numbers only, no special characters.
This is
one of those things where, you know, you can say we do this badly or we do this poorly, but it almost goes back onto itself with the lawyers and legal framework stuff moving slower than cybersecurity. You know, what moves just as glacially slow are rules, laws, and regulations around these requirements for cybersecurity also. You talked about NIST just now made these changes, even though this conversation has been going on about passwords for at least a decade.
The other one that's been going on for a while is phishing simulations. There's been a fair amount of research that has found that the phishing simulation training does almost nothing to reduce your actual vulnerability to phishing. And there are folks that'll just click on anything, no matter how obvious it is. And we do know what controls work. We know that patching quickly works against 0 days. We know that least privilege keeps attackers from installing malware on endpoints. No admin rights on workstations, like I just said, a lockdown proxy that blocks known malicious sites. We're not failing because we don't know what to do. We know what to do.
Yeah. I mean, we're failing because it's hard. And like we just talked about a minute ago, you know, the businesses has not judged that risk as high as people want to say for cybersecurity to force those things to, you know, to force our implementation or to pay for the implementation around those things, which we know we need to do.
Yeah, it's not worth it financially for the companies to do it. So we've talked about this before, but if IT did everything right, like the security team could be like one dude or one IR dude,
right?
Like one compliant person, and that's it.
Yep. And we may even get there with the rise of AI and automation and AI's ability to script. You know, if you get to the point where AI could script an automation to do patch management, you know, we might eventually get there, but it's probably still a long ways away. But there would be after you'd be significant trust. AI would have to significantly improve, and there'd have to be a significant level of trust for us to get to that point, though. But he also mentions insurance favorably in here, which Matt and I have probably beat to death, about how insurance companies could help with the ability to properly identify what things do work best and which don't across, you know, large industries based on insurance claims and how insurance companies could work to force those, well, not force necessarily, but to incentivize companies to take steps that do have been proven to be successful.
So Ross also brought up how the CrowdStrike incident is going to change both technical and legal teams because of their decision-making process. He thinks that technical teams with their evaluation of tools, probably not much will change. This type of incident is kind of hard to test for and is really kind of a black swan for how often it occurs. It has a high impact, but doesn't happen all that often. But it is going to significantly change how legal teams draft and review contracts.
Well, I think as part of that review, also, you're going to get content changes in those contracts, right? You're going to have more statements about the vendor will do this regression testing. They will do phase rollouts, et cetera, kind of things. I think you're going to start seeing in that when you talk about third-party management.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Because the whole point of reviewing the contracts is just not to review the contracts. It's to put stuff in the contracts, which is going to reduce risk and exposure. So unless they have those kind of things in there, there's no real point in the legal team getting involved in the contracts in that way.
We talked before about how the authors of the paper believe this would reduce information sharing, which I find incredibly vexing because the same attackers are targeting all of us. They're using the same techniques, the same infrastructure, until they're forced to change it. As the authors mentioned, lawyers are focused on evidence and risk or liability reductions, and IR folks are usually focused on information enrichment and sharing, regardless of what this does to liability.
Yeah, I'm wondering if the consideration there might be that the lawyers might also think there's a possibility for exposing regulatory or other violations or failures in that sharing.
I don't know. Yeah, because I mean, this goes back to the liability thing. They don't want you to come up with conclusions. They don't want to know where the root cause is. And this is related to the reduced documentation. They don't want you to, if you discover that the root cause is, you know, some admin put an NENE on the firewall as part of testing last month, they don't want that in an email because now that's going to come out. Mm-hmm. And the SEC want to have access to that. And they're like, hey, this is not part of the compliance that you're supposed to be.
Yeah, because if you share why something happened and it may expose, you know,
a
failure or violation, then.
Yeah, that's interesting. We're definitely going to see fewer indicators. I think we will see fewer indicators shared through Threat Intel and NYSEC. That's fairly self-evident. But there was an interesting point here about hiring forensic providers. I think you had a quote.
Yeah, there's a quote in the paper, not the article, but the paper itself, which will be linked in the show notes, which states, to argue this more clearly, law firms hire forensic providers only after an incident is known. This avoids the situation following Capital One's data breach, a judge ruled that a forensics report was not protected by client-attorney privilege because the contract with the forensics firm was signed before the incident. So I'm wondering how that or if that would impact forensics or IR firm retainers.
But that's so wild to me because you sign this retainer because you're worried that something like this is going to happen, that an emergency like this is going to happen. That doesn't preclude you from still engaging. I don't know. This makes a lot of no sense to me.
Yeah. Well, the judge said so, Matt. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And we know that judges are C students.
And infallible C students.
I don't know what to make of this, honestly. It seems like every Fortune 200 company probably has a retainer.
You don't want to be caught out where something hits the fan, you contact a forensic vendor like, hey, we're booked, right? Yeah. That's the whole point of the retainer. But I don't know. I'm speculating on the retainer thing because I don't know if the Capital One thing was related to them having a forensic company on retainer or not. I don't know. But I'm just wondering, it kind of sounds like that might impact it based on what the judge said.
Yeah, maybe. All right. So last question for this article. It looks like we might have time to finish like 5 minutes for the next one. They comment on the Tournament of Lawyers as an internal business structure of law firms. This is based on a book from like 30 years ago where they would, when there's been TV shows about this, they hire a bunch of low-level law clerks and like force them against each other and have them compete against each other to be promoted to partner. And the paper asked if it'd be adopted by vendors. I don't know why they would, but I did think it'd be an interesting thought experiment for like cybersecurity. How would cybersecurity be different if junior employees were kind of pitted against each other adversarially? And then the winners got moved up to a partner-like thing where they got paid extremely well, like a lawyer structure. Because if I've seen numbers for lawyers these days, the average salary for lawyers used to be like $150,000, $200,000 a year. And the average salary now is like $50,000. Because you've got these partners at the law firms that make, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousand dollars a year and big bonuses. But the vast majority of lawyers are making like $30,000, $40,000 a year, low-level clerk jobs or working for companies.
Yeah, it's like the street drug dealer only makes as much as
McDonald's worker or something. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. But the people in charge of the drug gang, they make millions and millions of dollars. It's just capitalism, baby.
Well, evil is as evil is, right?
Yeah.
Whether you're a banker, a lawyer, or a drug dealer.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Do you think this would drive better outcomes if we paid, you know, principal cybersecurity engineers and cybersecurity managers as much as like well-paid lawyers?
No. No, I mean, because what that breeds is that breeds conflict versus cooperation, right? And you much rather have cooperation than conflict. And I would just refer to everything that Deming has said about incentives and pitting employees against each other, which is extremely negative. You know, I think that would be a terrible, terrible, terrible idea.
That's fair. I actually was looking up lawyer salaries. Apparently, I'm wrong.
There's 60,000.
Average lawyer salary is now... 130 is a median of 135,000. The best paid 25% made 209,000, and the lowest paid made 94,000. I'm trying to think of where I saw that other number. I saw a number for lawyers that was really surprisingly low.
One for this public defenders.
I don't know. Public defender salaries. Because I remember reading about it after the big surge in lawyers in the early 2000s, because everybody's like, oh, lawyers make so much money. We just have to, you know, go through and average salary for public defenders, 85,000. Although this one, oh, that's interesting. Indeed says 85,000. Payscale says 62,000. I guess different folks submitted to this.
Well, they have different data pools. So.
Yeah, and Glassdoor says 98,000. So that's awesome. So all these are very believable.
It's only as good as the sources. It's like election polls.
So here we go. The average salary for attorney in Vermont is 85,000. This one's a law school degree. Are you reading? All right. Anyways, I'm getting into the weeds on something that really doesn't matter. All right. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. That'd be a good idea, but I think it would be interesting. I'm sure that some company does this right now. There's probably some company.
CEO
as a former lawyer thinks that this is the right way to do things. I'd be interested in reading about that company.
Well, that reminds me of GE and what's his name?
Jack Welch.
Yes, exactly. Where the lowest guy on the totem pole got cut every year.
stack ranking. Yeah, like
yeah, very similar thing.
Yeah, I actually am not. I don't know. My problem with stack ranking is that you have to fire someone every year. What if you've got a really high performing team? Right. I do think that there's probably more people that should be fired. And I don't necessarily think that that's because they're bad people or they're lazy. I just think there's probably a lot of people that are in the wrong jobs that are just kind of like cruising along.
Need to be incentivized to move on.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we've talked about this before. I don't want to fire people because I think that they deserve to be punished. I think there's some people that are just cruising and doing a mediocre to poor job, and someone needs to kick them a little and be like, hey, you could be working somewhere you actually enjoy it. Maybe. I don't know.
It's possible.
It's possible.
I've heard of that.
I've heard of enjoying your work. One day I hope to experience it. All right. Next article. I'm going to blaze through this real fast. Attack B16 brings rebalance with restructured cloud, new analytics, and more cyber criminals. I don't want to go through all the changes in attack for V16. That's going to be a super boring discussion. So I just want to call out one thing. One of their goals this year was expanding the content engineering content. I reused content twice. They added a total of 231 new analytics under execution, credential access, and cloud-specific analytics, which is this last year has just been an absolute explosion of content engineering. Yeah, 10 years ago, every company was on its own for SIEM roles.
Wait, 231, is that? That's got to be close to doubling the existing count, isn't it?
Well, I've looked at them. They're not very specific. They definitely need a lot of work, but it does give you a starting place. It gives you something. They're not like a Sigma rule where it comes with specific stuff. But they tend to be fairly general, like, hey, look in this source type and this index. It's funny too. You can tell by looking at the analytic where the author, like some of them are very Splunk-centric analytics and others are more generic.
Mm-hmm.
But it gives you a place to start looking, which I appreciate. Because sometimes you look at some of these and you're like, I don't even, like, which data source would I even look at for this? And then you have to do a bunch of research. So it definitely shortens the development cycle.
It's getting huge.
Tag is getting huge. So yeah, we've got companies now where you can buy a whole content library. There are multiple free Sigma repositories online where you can get free content. Attack is adding analytics. We are now at the point where we have a surplus of basic content. There are thousands and thousands of analytics out there. You can go and you can just throw in your SIEM with some level of customization.
Yeah, I need to start rating this like IOCs, where, you know, you get a ton of IOCs, confidence. How do you determine the quality here?
Yeah, that's the question, because now we've got our own problems. Are these good detections? Which should you implement? If you tried to implement all of the public analytics and the release of attack, you can't just throw 200 plus analytics in there and expect them to work. And they won't. Like I said, they're kind of general. They're more like starting points than actual finished products.
Yeah.
So I think it makes sense that the next step will be prioritization and filtering of the analytics. And some of those companies I talked about where you can buy a content library, we talked about them, I guess, last year. Some of them have like rating scales where you can rate the analytics on which ones are the best ones and which ones you like. But I would love to see things like the true positive rate for this analytic. How much work does it take to get customized in the environment? A lot of stuff around that, a lot of metadata around the analytics.
Right. Yeah, it goes back to what we were talking about in the last one with the information sharing. Where, it would be nice if, the detections and the true positive, false positives was automatically uploaded in a generic way to a centralized, maybe MITRE ATT&CK database or whatever. And then you could get an aggregate understanding about the quality of that item.
Yeah, because you don't need all the rules. You don't have to cover all of the tactics and techniques in MITRE. Adversaries only use some of them. I did this activity myself last year where I downloaded like 10 threat reports and I combined and counted up which attacks were mentioned in each of them. And even if you like combine them, I think it was like PowerShell and command line was mentioned in every single one of those reports. And then there were other things that were only mentioned in, two or three of the reports, and others that were mentioned in one. And then like 90% of attack was never mentioned at all. Mm-hmm. Like just because somebody used it at one point in time doesn't mean that it's, the easiest thing to use or the most likely to be used.
Right. And, and this is the kind of analysis that I think, threat intel teams could be doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Which of these do we need to care about? Look, this one is coming up. It's being used. We're seeing it being mentioned more and more, but we have minimal coverage on it. Like we need to beef up this coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's useful threat intel. Not these reports. Not these strategic bubble reports.
Yeah, about whatever Russia's doing.
Yeah. Do not care what Russia's doing. Tell me how attackers are getting in, tell me what the most popular methods are, and then what I need to be focused on in the next 3 months. All right. I don't know that I want to cover the rest of this. Is there anything later on here that you want to?
No. So that's it. So thanks for joining us, and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.
Leave us a review, because that's why nobody listens to us.
Hey, both our fans are rabid.